Hello and welcome to this week's Football Fans Podcast with your host, myself, Jordan. On the pod this week, I'm joined by Spurs fan Ollie from the Fulhamish podcast, Jack, and Man United fan Michael. On the pod this week, we're going to be talking and having a chat about Fulham. Have they got off the hook big time? And should there be some serious questions being asked about their relegation? Poch, has he finally convinced Ollie he can do it when it matters? Or will Ollie now just say he has to now win the Champions League to get him on board? Also, Pep in Europe, Wagwan, has his credit in the bank at Barca afforded him failures in Europe at Bayern and Manchester City? And in this slightly extended podcast, we're going to be discussing Dutch football as well and its return to the top table. I wanted to do this show but way back in like November time, but for one reason or another, I haven't got round to it. So we'll have a little chat later on about Dutch football and its re-emergence amongst the football elite. Gentlemen, we well?
Too bad, man.
All good.
Good, good, good. Let's get some drive-by straight away, guys. I'll start with you, Ollie. Wayne Hennessy escaped an FA charge after declaring he was unaware... You're laughing already. After declaring he was unaware of the significance of the hand signal he made at, I believe it was at Crystal Palace Christmas party, the signal being a Nazi salute. Have the FA once again set a dangerous precedent, allowing a player to get off with the "I didn't know what it meant" defence?
There's an argument to say that, you know, that maybe he didn't know.
No, there's
what
no
you're
argument.
Saying, you know, but, you know, I'm saying.
You're being very generous.
I'm
there.
Being really I'm not generous. That. I'm being really generous, but it's incredible, really, that someone could say that they've never. Have they never watched any war film? They've never watched Dad's Army, even? They've never watched anything.
That Forget even them. That. I've not seen a war film or watched Dad's Army, but even I. You know what I mean? You just know from being an adult
well, exactly,
certain things.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I can't understand how he's got away with that defence. It's incredible, really. I mean, what next? I mean, what else can you say? You've never.
That's what's worrying, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
he doesn't know that.
If you can get away with that, you can get away with anything, really.
And is that where the FA have really messed up here now? Because any infringement going forward from a player or anybody now, they can always get away with the, well, I wasn't aware what that word meant or what that signal meant.
Yeah, you know absolutely. I mean? Absolutely. Yeah, I find it astounding, really. I'm trying to be charitable to the guy, but really, words fail me.
It's a mess. Michael, no, Jack first. Drop the gun here. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has called out many of the Manchester United team and asked them in a presser, this was pre-Everton, to fix up. And there's talk of players being new players being needed. Wasn't Jose saying a similar thing when he was in charge?
Yeah, he was. I do feel sorry a bit for Ollie, to be honest. I don't think he's maybe tactically there in terms of you look at his previous history and where he's come from and all those things. And yes, he was successful in Norway. That's a bit of a different ball game. I do think that there's not enough kind of heart and passion and fight in it in many ways. But obviously that press conference hasn't worked, given results have, you know, since then. Yes, it is very similar in season in terms of what Mourinho was saying. And I think there is something to be said for that. But at the same time, there needed a change in terms of in personnel, in terms of making sure that the people that are built around are the right people at the club. And I think that Mourinho was starting to, you know, isolate the big names, the really big names at the club, the likes of Pogba, who you know, while they haven't been brilliant recently, you know, are kind of, I think, what you need to build around if you're going to make United a successful force in the game again.
Make United great again.
Yeah, make United great again in many regards. So I think that there's, you know, there are differences between what the situation is now and what it was at the end of Mourinho's tenure. But I imagine that Jose Mourinho was watching the game on Sunday with a wide smile on his face.
And finally, Michael, wins against Chelsea, Arsenal and now United in the last couple of months. Let's give Marcus Silva his due. I've not criticised him. I've questioned him this season. But fair play. I'm a fair man. Is he getting it right? And if so, have you seen any tangible difference in the last couple of months? Or is it just another 2 months really good, then it'll be 2 months really bad, and then it'll be 2 months really good again?
It does smell of a typical Everton thing where they just disappear and they come back out of nowhere. However, it's been established now that 7th to 9th is like the Everton Cup.
Everton Cup's what we call it,
Everton Cup, so you know, you finish 7th, you've done what Everton are supposed to do. So maybe they're aiming for that right now.
You haven't seen anything in those wins or in the last few months that you think, okay, he just needed a bit of time and this is what he was working towards?
I've seen a bit more of a cohesion within the team. I think everyone's a lot more concise with what they're supposed to do, what their role is, and they look a lot more comfortable playing as a team on the pitch, and everyone actually knows what they're doing. Mm. So they're getting results in the right places now.
Okay. Before we get into the main point, let's just have a brief talk about the PFA candidates that was announced this week. We discussed the young player a couple of months back, so we won't do the young player again. PFA, first of all, let's keep this brief, guys. Start with you, Jack. Was there anybody on that list that you thought shouldn't have been on the list, and vice versa? Was anybody that wasn't on the list who you thought should have been in the six?
Not wildly. I thought it was broadly fair. I think that, you know, there are always going to be questions from certain fan groups as to why their star player hasn't been included, and that kind of question will never go away because everyone has their own confirmation bias about why, you know, why this player wasn't included. Oh, there's a bias against X club or Y club, and that always happens. But on the whole, I was okay with it, to be honest. I was all right.
Ollie, the two front runners are Van Dijk and Sterling.
Surprise, surprise.
Are those your two? And if so, who's leading at the moment?
I think that Sterling has to be in front, really, because he's his season's not just been great for Manchester City. It's how important he's become for England as well. He's become a real top player, you know, who can deliver on the big stage. And I think that he's sort of showing that, you know, he's proved me wrong, really, because as I said, you pointed out a few weeks or back, or the last time or a couple of times back that I was on about Sterling, I was concerned that he would go to Man City and flop, but he's actually gone there. Well, since Guardiola's turned up, he's moved forward, mm-hmm. and his career has really gone on to bigger and better things. I think marginally he should win it, and certainly if City win the league, then I think he'd be the right person to win the Premier League.
Well, on that point, Mike, I mean, we won't get into the debate of why the votes have been done so early, but will it seem really harsh on Van Dijk if Sterling wins it, yet Liverpool win the title?
It would seem that way, because I agree with Sterling should be winning it, because if there's only one person that can stop Van Dijk from winning a league title, it's Raheem Sterling, because Van Dijk has been absolutely ridiculous this season. He's been untouchable. No one's got past him. His defending has, it's been elite. I haven't seen a defender defending the Premier League like this for a long time. He's doing everything right, but Raheem Sterling is scoring all the goals. And on top of that, it's his overall gameplay that's improved so much now. He's become like almost a total package of what you want in a footballer. Mm. So if he's the person to stop Van Dijk winning the title, there's no debate towards who wins it, to be honest.
I hear you. Okay, I'm still going towards Van Dijk personally. It's funny because the hat trick goal that he scored against your mob on Wednesday, which was then disallowed, as soon as he scored it, my first thought was, nah, it's Sterling for PFA. Now it's Sterling for PFA. It got ruled out, and I was like, nah, maybe not anymore. Maybe not now. So I flip-flopped it within a matter of minutes. All right, let's get into the first debate, guys. Fulham, are they the worst team in Premier League history?
Sorry. Sorry. This is a funny question.
I'll start with you, Jack.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you're the Fulham fan here. I'm wondering if their relegation has massively gone under the radar, because we've got a really exciting title race, we've got an exciting top four race, England have had a decent season on an international scale, and people are kind of just overlooking the fact that the money you've spent and the expectations that were placed on you, no one's thinking you're going to win the title. You've kind of just like accepted, no, it's fun and they've gone down, and I'm not having it. I'm like, hang on a minute. I think it's quite embarrassing what's happened to Fulham. As a Fulham fan, I know that you were saying earlier on off air that you can't wait to go back to the Championship because you enjoy the Championship, and I see why. But do you accept that there needs to be some hard questions asked about, with that level of expenditure, you can just get relegated so soon and it not really be scrutinised?
Well, I think there are hard questions to ask, but I don't think that question you're asking is the hard question. Right, so you started off by suggesting to me that they're the most expensive flop in Premier League history. Maybe. You can maybe ask that question. Fulham are not the worst team in Premier League history. In fact, they're not bottom of the league. Like, it is, so, like, they're not even the worst team in the Premier League this year.
But when you factor in
the elements.
Right, okay, so let's have this right. Let's clear the air on this one. When Fulham started this season, before we signed anyone, we had 13 first team players.
Yes,
13.
We did.
If you take Fulham's wage bill this season and put that into context, we're in the bottom three of the Premier League. If you take all of those things, Fulham had to spend 100 million. In fact, I'd go so far to say that Fulham didn't spend enough this summer. Fulham needed to spend 200 million to compete. And the problem is, the reason they had to do this is because we based our kind of going up transfer around some players, a very, very small core group of players, which is what Jokanović liked. He liked having a very small core that he relied on and trusted. So Fulham only used sort of 16, 17 players last season, really, on the whole, in kind of games that mattered. And so five, I think, of those were loanees. Yeah, you look at that and you look at then Ryan Fredericks leaving on a free this summer after the club, you know, which I think is reasonable. West Ham paid him what would have made him Fulham's highest paid player. Mm. And he's a right back. Don't get me wrong, he's a perfectly good right back, but he's a right back. Mm-hmm. Like, and you can't have your right back as your highest paid player. No. It's unacceptable. So therefore, you can't really do much about that. So Fulham had to replace that. They had to replace the other four loanees who left in the summer. And then they had to strengthen the squad that was there already. So, like,
but don't get me wrong, I'm not saying Fulham should have been competing for the top six.
No.
But to not even stay up,
yeah,
with the spending that you've made, that is really bad.
I just think, like, people look at Wolves, right? And people forget that Wolves have spent similar amounts of money, but on a longer scale. So what they did was they spent half of it in the Championship because they gambled they were going to go up and then did it then. And then people are like, oh, Wolves didn't spend that much time. They only spent 70 million. Yeah, but they also spent 70 million last summer.
But I'm not comparing you to Wolves. I'm just suggesting that with your expenditure, you got some good players. I'm not having this, the players aren't that good. You've got some good players at Fulham, I think.
Yeah.
And to be relegated by March, like I think
who?
Is really the poor.
Like who?
I think Sessegnon's a good young talent. I think
he hasn't
shown
anything.
He hasn't done very much.
He's been poor. He's been poor this year. But he's not a poor player though.
Yeah, but he hasn't shown his Premier League. He's ready for the Premier League yet, has he?
He's got the second most assists for a teenager in Europe.
I think
the Premier League
in Europe.
But I just don't. He's hardly played.
He has hardly.
He's got
played.
Five assists.
He's 18. It's not
they five assists isn't a lot though, is it?
It's not. But Fulham have been rubbish. So like, therefore, you know, it is one of those things you have to accept it in the context. Mitrovic is 11 goals in the context.
I'm not saying he's a bad player.
No, I
agree with everything you've just said, Jack. I'm not saying he's a bad player. I'm just saying that I don't really agree with that argument that Fulham have got loads of great players.
No, not loads.
I totally agree with Jack.
But they've got players that shouldn't be in the bottom three. Fulham should not be in the bottom. They've got significantly better players than Cardiff. Significantly better players than Huddersfield.
But Cardiff,
better players than Brighton,
Cardiff,
I would
suggest. But Cardiff were a cohesive unit who came up and they've got a kind of, you know, they've got a team spirit there and, you know, they're pretty much the same as they were when they came up. Fulham, as Jack said, needed to change their squad around and get some new players in. And, you know, it hasn't worked. And it never works when you bring in a load of players under one manager and then you get rid of that manager and then you know, and then the new manager comes in with new ideas and probably thinks that the players that have been bought aren't good enough for what he wants to do.
I think there are questions that need to be asked, heavy questions about the managerial change, right? Because Jokanović obviously wasn't doing enough and the points weren't coming. But instead of appointing a manager who it was in Jokanović's mould and used the same kind of, you know, players and the same kind of strategies, Fulham went the entire opposite way and put a Catenaccio coach in who basically wanted to defend, despite the fact that Fulham haven't got any defenders, and wanted to sit and hold and play on the break when our main striker was Alexander Mitrovic. You know, it's hardly the lightning pace of Jamie Vardy, is it? So, you know, when we appointed Ranieri, a lot of us were sceptical. You know, I thought it might be okay. I thought it might work out because Ranieri, I thought, would be able to adapt his philosophies to fit the club. That didn't happen at all. What happened was that Ranieri tried to impose his own philosophy on a group of players that weren't able to carry out that philosophy. And as soon as that happened, it was curtains because Fulham didn't have the capacity, in a personnel capacity, to play a Ranieri system. We didn't have the capacity to be defending. We needed to win games 4-3. That was what we were going to do if we were going to stay up. We needed to beat teams by outscoring them. So we did it last year, and how we were going to have to do it again. And I think that we would have done if we'd appointed, in fact, Southampton 2 weeks after Fulham appointed Ranieri, Southampton appointed Hasenhüttl. I think if Fulham had appointed Ralf Hasenhüttl when they sacked Jokanović, Fulham would have stayed up.
Interesting. Mike, am I being harsh or are they slightly just been, it's been accepted, oh, it's a nice little Fulham, yeah, they gave it their best, got some, all right, you know, next year, try again.
As long as they don't perform like Derby did years back, they're absolutely fine.
But this, I think this is the crux of my point. Derby had... They did have crap players.
They
had crap players. So when they finished with the record low, you kind of expected that. They don't have crap players.
They don't have crap players, but the cohesive unit is a big thing. You know, when you spend a lot of money and you try and bring them into a team, it doesn't click straight away. And when the pressure is to stay up, and considering your defence is not great, I mean, first of all, signing Tifosi Mensah was probably the worst thing you could have ever
done. Yeah, no, agreed.
But please take him with you.
No. Honestly, have him back.
No, I don't want him.
I thought United fans liked him. No, this year he's not been good, but I thought before even now.
Our fan base is deluded, so, you know.
So that's another subject.
that's a different argument.
But I don't think they have a great team of players. I think there's maybe two or three individuals you can look at. One's potential. Seri was a surprising signing, but he's done very, really, very little. And I like Rico. But those are the only three I look at and I say they've got something about them. The rest of them I'm not impressed.
Who's the guy you bought in midfield for 35 million?
Andre Frank, nah. No. Zamba and Giza.
Yes, right, yeah. Wait,
who's that? Honestly, he's going to be a baller in the Championship. I think he's so good. Like he came in, he didn't really fit under Jokanović because everyone thought he was a six. He wasn't a six, he was an eight. And he didn't play, they tried to play him as defensive midfielder. And what he loves doing is like marauding around and doing what he wants. He can't do that without a defensive midfielder next to him. He did it in Marseille with Luis Gustavo next to him. And so eventually, when they realised he had to play Callum Chambers next to him, he had two good games and he got injured. He came back from his injury and has been our best player in the last five games.
I heard a lot of hype about him when you signed him. And I've watched him, I was a bit like...
If we can keep hold of him, he's going to tear the Championship up.
Scott Parker, Ollie, is in the hot seat at the moment.
Yeah.
I imagine he'll get the job. Do you think that it's a good appointment? I don't expect you to be an expert on him. Or do you think there's a little bit of romance going on there that because he's a coach and he knows the club?
It's a cheap appointment.
Yeah.
It's an appointment that you make if you know you're going down to the Championship.
Mm.
So it's a sensible appointment. You can't have someone like Ranieri. I mean, God knows how much money he was clearing at Fulham when they brought him in. I mean, people like Ranieri don't come cheap.
Mm.
So if you bring in Parker on the proviso that he knows that he's going in there to, you know, he's going to learn on the job and hopefully he's going to, you know, he's going to move forward with them, then that's the idea is that, you know, they can grow together and hopefully it will work out. But I think it's a sensible appointment. I don't think it's anything more than that.
Mm.
I think they look at it now and think, well, he's the coach. He knows his way around the club. Let's get this guy in. Let's give him the job and see what he can do. Because, you know, Fulham are going down. They knew they were going down quite a long time ago and they brought him in to do a job. And, you know, you have to look at it and think, well, since he's been in there, there's definitely been an upturn in results.
But they've gone down, though.
Once you've gone, it's easy to play better.
To get
back-to-back wins, I think even when they still had a chance, they were still putting in better performances.
Couldn't get worse.
It could.
Yeah, it couldn't have got much worse, to be fair. Ranieri was actually terrible.
Well, Ranieri tried to bring in a different style and it didn't really work. But I actually think that, you know, Fulham have looked a lot better since Scott Parker went in there than when Ranieri was around. And yeah, I think that's good. I think going down, what you don't want to be doing is going down into the Championship on a downer. Do you know what I mean? No. At least with Parker there now, there's a base. People can think, all right, okay, you know, we've put in a few decent performances. You go into the Championship on an upturn rather than going down and you're in a real state and everyone wonders where you're going to go from here, you know?
What's the fan base saying? Is he the right guy for the job? And if so, what is the job? Is it to come back next year or just accept that maybe you might be in the Championship for another couple of years, restabilise and plan for two or three years?
So when Fulham went down the last time, we were in absolute state. We didn't have any long-term contracts. We ended up having really old players and really young players and nothing in the middle. And we had Felix Magath at the helm, who everyone was, you know, they didn't really like. It was all a bit chaos. You know, we had to bring in Kit Simons to steady the ships and an old Fulham head to kind of basically just be like, whoa, let's slow this down a bit and not get relegated. And so obviously this time, when you look and, you know, you think of the kind of business side of it, we've made sensible contracts, all those kind of things. There are relegation kind of cut contract clauses in every single player we sign this summer. There are, those things are going to make Fulham sustainable again with parachute payments. Obviously that helps. And when we go down this time, I think we're in a much better place than we were when we went down the first time. The truth for me on Parker is I think he's doing fine. He's got, you know, he's got the credentials, as in he's learned under Pochettino and he's learned under Jokanović and he's learned under Ranieri. And for all of their faults, you know, they in those two last two managers especially, they do have things that they're learning from it, and especially played under lots of great managers as well. You can hope that Parker has been taking that in, and he is a footballing brain and he is a thinker. And you can see with, you know, from his interviews and stuff that he is someone who respects the people that have gone before him and works from that. So I'm hoping that under those tutelages, he will have learned some important things about being a manager. But the key for me is if he can keep players around. If keeping Parker in the role convinces the likes of Kearney to stay, convinces the likes of Sessegnon to stay for another season, convinces Alexander Mitrovic to give it a one season in the Championship to get back up. You know, Mitrovic is 23. Mm. He's not, you know, he's not the, you know, the peak of his career by any stretch of the imagination yet. He's still very young. He likes being at Fulham. You know, he's very much settled his kids and things in London. It seems to be something he's kind of working towards. And Kearney's just had a child, literally yesterday. You know, congratulations, TC.
Happy birthday, we're going to say
I was going to say happy birthday. He's called his son Aubrey, which I imagine is after Drake, which is pretty nuts. But, you know, all of those things suggest to me that those players might stick around. Because, well, as in, he's not going to shift his entire family with a newborn up to Newcastle.
Why would you think that, say, for instance, if a Premier League club says, OK, Sessegnon had a bad season, but we're going to take a punt on him, and we'll probably get him for cheaper because he's not really pulled up any trees in the...
Fine. Fulham have already said they won't take less than 50 million for Sessegnon.
50 million?
That's what they say. But that's it. That's fine. Fine because that's the break clause. So it doesn't really matter. If someone wants to offer 50 million for Sessegnon, then he's going to go. That's fine. I'm okay with that. 30 million for Mitrovic. These are the price tags
they're
putting.
Surely you're not going to get 50.
No, I don't think we will, which is why I think he'll stay.
There's only one thing that's keep off doing such foolishness.
But that's it. I think that if Parker's appointment convinces those kind of players to give it a crack in the Championship and give it one crack at coming straight back up, then for it's a sensible appointment. If he doesn't, if those players are all leaving anyway, then Fulham should reel back and put in a Championship level coach, someone sensible from Europe who is willing to kind of take the philosophy of the club and build from there. That would be my take on it.
I hear that. Okay, let's move on, guys. Just before we do move on, I want to update on Snackgate. We actually do have some snacks this week. Can we get a video, Antonio, please, just to prove to some of our previous guests from the last couple of weeks that we do supply some snacks. So those listening, there it is.
They don't actually get open.
No, they don't.
They come back next week.
Yes. That's what it matters. All right, they're here. Right, let's move on to Manchester City, guys. Mike, let's look at Pep Guardiola now, and I want to caveat this question with, we're not talking about Pep Guardiola's managerial stint overall. Let's look at his European record post-Barcelona.
Okay.
Should he and Manchester City, considering what the owners said when they first came to town and took over at City, should he now be judged on his success rate in Europe? Or are you one of those people that just accepts that, you know, the Champions League, like any cup competition, anything can happen. It's hard to use that as a measuring stick for anybody. Or with 3 years, big budget spent, one of the best teams in Europe, should he now be getting, if not winning it, getting to a final?
He should be getting to a final.
Come into the mic, Mark.
He should be getting to the final. The way it was for me is that, obviously, when he left Barcelona and went to Bayern Munich, he got to 3 semi-finals in his 3 years there. When each of the semi-finals, he got smashed to pieces.
Smashed, yeah.
He got absolutely destroyed. Real Madrid destroyed him. Barcelona destroyed him. And he got destroyed again. He's come to Man City and he's not reached a semi-final since. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of City, I've had questions over some of their players in terms of Europe in general anyway. I mean, someone like Aguero, I believe Aguero is one of the best players we've seen in the Premier League history. But in Europe, he is very, very... he's questionable. I can't look at him and say I can rely on you to perform for me in the Champions League, because he has not done it in the Champions League. So a lot of factors come into that. But, you know, he lost... Well, if you lose Messi, I mean, you're not going to replace Messi with anybody, really. But as soon as he left that Barcelona team, he has not accomplished what he was brought in for. Bayern Munich brought him in to continue what Hayek has left at that club. He brought in his philosophy. He brought in Javi Martinez with him, and it worked well in domestically. But when he came to Europe and he came to the main occasion against the big boys that were challenging you for the trophy, he didn't do it. Now he's at City, he's having the same problem. And I would argue and say this is his squad now, so there is no excuse. Mm. Last season, they got smashed by Liverpool in the first leg. Didn't learn and went to the second leg and conceded more goals. You lost 1-0 away to Tottenham. You thought you could play three essentially attacking midfielders and their three forwards and somehow not concede goals. They conceded two goals within the first 10 minutes. So you've pretty much shut down what your chances of going through. And if it was, obviously, it was a VAR save Spurs, but you wouldn't have been in that position if you approached it differently. You've got the quality to beat Tottenham.
So he has VAR save Spurs.
He was offside. No, that's what I'm saying, though. It was right, it's the right decision. It was the right decision. But if VAR wasn't there, then you would have been saying it was, you know what I mean? So he has to be questioned at this point. you have to ask the questions and say, was it you? Were you winning Champions League because obviously what you had at Barcelona plus Messi was just extraordinary, not taking away what he did for the team and the players he brought in from Barcelona to B. And now can he do it with other players considering how much money he spent?
See, Jack, I wonder if it's fair to say that post Barca in Europe he's failed. So that's three seasons at Bayern and three seasons at Manchester City. Is saying that he's failed in Europe a bit of a stretch? Or do you just accept that that's just how, you know, cup competitions at that level go?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of a bit with you. I think it's so mad that these things, like, fail on such small margins, right? You know, Aguero scores that penalty in the first leg. The entire tie is different, right? And suddenly we've gone, or that goal, you know, Aguero is one step behind where he is and he is, you know, let's say just is onside in the end. And suddenly Poch is a fraud and Pep's a genius. And just because, you know, that one step and suddenly Pep's a fraud and Poch is a genius. And everyone's so reactive about everything at the moment. And it's kind of mad. You know, Pep's philosophy is that he wants to play perfect football everywhere he's gone. That's what he's, you know, what he's tried to do. And he's always said it's not always about, you know, this doesn't always bring results. And especially in the Champions League, it's very difficult to go out there and try and impose that philosophy on 11 excellent teams that you're playing against. You know, you get to these late stages of competition. That's, you know, to do such a disrespect. Spurs are an unbelievable team. You know, that team there is unreal. All right, says Jordan in the Arsenal top. But, you know, that Spurs team is exceptional and managed by an exceptional manager. And I do think that having Harry Kane out the second leg helped in terms of the kind of reactive nature of how you can play on the break a bit more against the City a City midfield, like you rightly pointed out, Michael, who didn't really have a defensive midfielder in there. But, you know, it very nearly worked. Like, you know, it very, very nearly worked. And yes, it didn't. And yes, you have to accept that Pep hasn't done what he set out to do in Europe in all of those things. But at the same time, you know, domestic competitions are where you see, I think, you measure success on a long-term basis. Because if you're trying to impose a philosophy over the course of a 38-game season or a 40-game season or wherever you are, you know, then you're able to do that on a dominant level time and time and time and time and time again. And that's where you kind of blend your thing. In a cup competition, there's always going to be an element of random surprise. And I do think that you have to look at Pep's record in Europe and be like, you probably should have done better. But I think that the margins that these things rest on, you know, you rightly mentioned the Liverpool game, but City went 1-0 up in that second leg and should have had a penalty straight away afterwards. If that gets given and they score, then they're on the front foot chasing one more goal and suddenly the entire tie is different.
So the ifs and buts of it.
Of course, but there are always going to be ifs and buts about different teams.
I take your point. There are fine lines.
There are very small margins in these competitions. And I think to suggest that he's been a total failure, given what he's trying to achieve in a kind of football philosophy sense, is a little bit mad. You look at Bayern still reaping the benefits in terms of the way they play. I know that we've got to the point now where the Bayern have reached the end of their cycle and this year's been a bit of a mess, but they're probably still going to win the Bundesliga. You know, they're still reaping the benefits of what Pep put in there as a Barcelona. And I think it's kind of mad to suggest that he is in any way sort of not a genius because his managerial record in Europe hasn't quite led to titles on that sphere, given the nature of the competition.
And I think if he does win the Champions League his way, I think it will be all the more sweeter for him as well. Ollie, three seasons in a row now, three quarterfinals. If you were a Manchester City fan, would you have questions at the bare minimum about his approach in Europe? Or would you, as Jack says, accept that he wants to win trophies and titles his way, and if he doesn't, then that's just, we got to accept that we might not win the Champions League ever under Pep Guardiola?
Well, we're still looking at a Man City side who may well do something that no one's ever done, which is win all three trophies, domestic trophies. I mean, that would be incredible. We were talking, up until last week, we were talking about a quadruple, and it was something that was, you know, likely to happen. It was, you know, they were in with a chance of it happening. So he doesn't become a bad manager overnight, I don't think.
No. I want to make it clear. I'm not saying he's a bad manager. I'm just, you know, European record, you know, post-Barca, I'm questioning.
People criticised him. You know, everyone's got a right. Everyone's got an opinion, haven't they?
But at the end of the day, people will turn around and say, well, you know, he didn't play De Bruyne in the first leg. He should have played De Bruyne. Look what's happened to De Bruyne now.
He knows there was a reason why he didn't play him.
There's a reason why he didn't play De Bruyne. There's a reason, you know. So people can talk as much as they like, but in the end, he had good reason not to play De Bruyne because he obviously felt that, you know, the guy was on the edge of getting injured. And lo and behold, he plays one game too many. He probably thought to himself, you know what, I don't want to play De Bruyne in this game against Spurs on Saturday, but he thought he had to.
It's a must win,
And in taking that risk, the guy's gone down and he's probably, you know, he's probably going to miss out.
I think it's done for the season.
Or for the rest of the season. So, you know, these are, as Jack's saying, these are the fine margins. These are the decisions you have to make as a manager, and people don't know what's going on behind the scenes. We don't know what was wrong with Aguero. Aguero went into that semi-final, and I thought, oh, is this cardiology going into the first leg? But he, clearly, there was something clearly not right with Aguero, and I don't think Aguero's been quite right ever since he came back from whatever knock it was that he had prior to the first leg. So, you know, those are two big players for Man City if they're not fit.
I don't think Edison was fit as well. In the first leg against Spurs as well, he made a save where he made a kick and he kind of slightly pulled up and no one really mentioned it. And I don't know if it's a coincidence, but the goal, the first goal you scored in the second leg, where he kind of saved his leg but kind of didn't. I was wondering if he went that second leg as well.
I think not quite fully fit. If you look across the whole piece and look at what City had and didn't have, they didn't have a left back, right? You know, Mendy wasn't fit. So he had to, you know, he had to play Delph in the first leg. And it was Delph who made the mistake for the goal. So you haven't played Delph. You can't play De Bruyne. Aguero's half fit. You know, and in the end, you've got to look at it and think, well, people are saying, oh, wouldn't it be great? Everyone's talking about the quadruple. The pressure's on for them to keep going in every competition. But after a while, we all know, we've watched football for long enough now, we all know the games take their toll. You know, every game, you know, they're playing every week. Game after game after game, whereas Liverpool are playing, you know, Liverpool have gone out of the cup competitions pretty early.
Well, the irony is that it might be the reverse now. Liverpool might have a slight pile up towards the end of the season now with the Champions League.
And but Man City have been playing FA Cup, League Cup, you know, league, in the league, Europe, in the Champions League. Every game, high octane, and you can't keep it up. And I think that people need to cut Pep some slack, basically, because essentially it was one game too far. It was, you know, the whole tie, it was one, you know, that's not to say the Spurs didn't have injuries as well, because it did, you know, went into the game. We had more injuries from the first leg to the second leg. But still, I think Man City had a few injuries. And I also think in terms of looking at it across the whole piece of, you know, him not winning it for three seasons, let's be honest, right? No one wins the Champions League apart from Real Madrid and Barcelona. Who wins it?
I guess everyone's
talking about, you know, oh, Pep hasn't won it for 3 years. Nobody in Europe's won it for. When's the last? Who are the last club to win it outside of Spain?
Bayern.
Bayern, wasn't it? Bayern?
When was that?
2013.
Right. So 2013, no clubs won it outside of Barcelona and Real Madrid. That's a long time. You know, so, you know, Pep's not on his own here.
No.
It's not just down to Pep to do it. Yes, Pep's got a lot of money and they spent a lot of money at Manchester City and all the rest of it. But at the end of the day, all of Europe can't keep up with Barcelona and Real Madrid. If Real Madrid don't win it, Barca will win it. You know, we'll have to wait and see. But Barca is in it now, you know, in the semi-final now, and they'll be looking at it now saying, well,
they're probably the favourites, aren't they?
They're the favourites. Yeah. And for good reason. Because when those clubs get to the final, they normally win it.
They normally do. I guess what my thing is, in that I'm saying that Pep should have won the Champions League by 9 3 years at City. I'm saying, should it be questioned that he hasn't been able to get to at least a semi-final, if not a final? I mean, if you can't win it, you can't win it. But surely by now, in the three seasons, with the squad that he's had, he should have been able to progress past the quarters. And I accept, as you mentioned, that there was fine margins in the last, well, this and last season in particular. But does it suggest that maybe he's not learning from something? Or do you think, as Jack said, sorry, as earlier on, he's got his way of playing and I'm not going to deviate away from that? And if because that goes against what I believe.
Well, I think that's the thing. It's like, obviously, because of how he's won things in the past, it's hard to tell him you shouldn't play this style in a certain game, because what he's done with his style has been incredible. So it's like you can't really get at him and tell him that, well, you should do something different, because
what he's done before worked.
It's worked. It's worked domestically at Bayern. It's worked in the Premier League. It's worked for Barcelona. We saw it work tenfold. But I think where the questions come from fans is some of the manners of the defeat that he had.
There's a lot of goals. I counted the goals in the last all three seasons, and there's a lot of goals he's conceded in the quarterfinals.
That's the whole point. I mean, like, the Liverpool one really rattled people because they got smashed in that first leg. Mm. In the first leg, it really rattled a lot of people because, like, how are Liverpool hitting you like this and you're not learning? Same way they hit you in the league. The league game was crazy. It was a 4-3 game. But again, conceding all those goals against a team, now you know their style and all that stuff, and people want you to adapt and do this and do that. So that's where the questions are coming from. To call him a failure, I don't think he's failed, because, like he's pointed out, I mean, Real Madrid won it 4 out of the last 5 years, and in between there was Barcelona.
Mm.
And they have what we consider two of the greatest players we've seen play football.
Mm.
Do their thing. So, you know, when you had those two juggernauts going at it, it's hard to go at him and say, you should have done this, you should have done that. At Bayern, he got smashed by two of those teams. So, you know, it's one of those things where I wouldn't call him a failure, but I understand why people are asking questions, but he hasn't failed in
Europe. Don't forget, Real Madrid is the sort of team who basically...
They live for the Champions League.
They live for the Champions League.
They're actually terrible domestically.
The first half of the season, they don't even bother turning up.
Yeah,
and then they're like, all right.
It's knockout time now.
It's February now. Let's start playing Champions League.
Yeah.
And also, just to come back on the point you were making at Michael, it needs to be remembered with what you were just saying. Pep did try and change it for that first leg. They didn't.
This season?
Against Spurs. They didn't come to Spurs and try to take the game to
no,
us.
No, they didn't. They didn't.
They came to Spurs and they were like, we're going to come out of here. Whatever happens, we're not going to get smashed.
Mm.
Yeah? And they came out, you know.
And then people criticised him for it.
As Jack said, you know, it's fine margins. And, you know, if Aguero scores that penalty, everyone sitting in the stadium was thinking, well, this is in. You know, I didn't expect Lloris to save that penalty. The bottom line is, Jordan, they had a chance to score. They missed the chance. That was their opportunity. But they came there and played a very cagey game. So it's not as though he didn't learn from the Liverpool defeat. He did learn. The last thing he wanted, he went into that.
I'm not getting smashed again first leg.
Not just that, but he knew all the kind of, you know, the hullabaloo about Spurs and the new stadium and all the rest of it. And he thought, this is just like going to Liverpool again. I'm not going to fall into that trap. He went there, he tried to play defensively, not defensively, but he tried to play a cagey game and they lost.
Mm.
You know,
just finally, briefly, Jack, considering what the owners want Manchester City to be this summer, do you call Pep in and say, you know, it's been 3 years now, we're not really close to getting what we want as owners? Or, like I said at the start, do you just accept that he's going to do it his way and it might mean in the next 2 or 3 years you don't get beyond the quarterfinal?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it very much depends on what he wins this summer. Like, like what he says, if he comes in with an unprecedented domestic treble, then maybe they'll be like, ah, yeah, fair enough. One back-to-back Premier Leagues with two of the greatest points tallies in Premier League history. I reckon they might be like, yeah, you're doing all right, actually. Yeah, maybe. His contract, bear in mind, his contract runs out next year.
That's next summer. Didn't extend it by a year?
Yeah, to next summer.
Okay.
He's got, you know, this summer, and he's got one more season. I imagine that, and, you know, the City fans that I spoke to after the game were saying the thing that could make this better is Pep came out and signed a 5-year contract. That would make everyone feel better about things. And I think that's the key thing. I think they believe in him, and I think an ownership would struggle to convince a fan base that they were bringing in, I don't know, Jupp Heynckes to come and win the Champions League. I think everyone would be like, you were right. Like, you know, this man's done absolute bits for 3 years. I think he'd probably leave us alone. So, yeah, I think he's probably all right.
Let's move on now. Ollie, there was another manager in the other dugout that was victorious in that game. You've often on this podcast over nearly 4 years now.
No,
I would never do that to you. Your big gripe with Pochettino has been, in the big games, when it really matters, time and time again, he comes up short. Well, he didn't this time. And I think there was elements of fortune, as you've all mentioned, in it.
I'm just saying.
there was some fortune in that game. Did he go up in your estimations in terms of crossing that line of getting over a big tie?
Sorry, go on.
No.
I was more impressed with the first leg than the second leg, I have to say, because I thought the second leg,
it was a bit of a free-for-all, wasn't it?
Yeah, I just thought they were too open. I mean, only Spurs could score two goals in the first 10 minutes, and you're still, by half time, you're still thinking,
We're going out here.
That's just incredible. If you'd have told me an hour before the game, you're going to score two in the first 10 minutes, I think, well, we'd be coasting then.
Yeah.
But we scored two, and then we conceded one a minute later. And you're just like, oh, man, this is. It was the most horrific experience I've ever been through. I have to tell you,
yeah.
I was rolling around in pain. It was like, it was like doing primal scream therapy or something. I was like, oh, stop doing this. It was awful to watch.
And, I loved it.
People would turn around and say, oh, it was a great game. It wasn't if you're a Spurs fan. It was terrible.
I can imagine.
But yeah, I just think he got it right in the first leg. I thought the first leg was fantastic, the way they managed the game. And, you know, at this stage of the competition, 1-0, I was fretting for the whole week afterwards, thinking, God, is one going to be enough? But in the end, that one goal was that was the difference.
The first time won you the first game won you the tie.
Yeah, the goal that Son scored in the first leg won us the tie, and I was more impressed with that performance than the second leg, where I just thought it was just too open. And but then the other thing is, you look at Tottenham and the squad that they had, and when they got the injury to Sissoko. You look at the bench and you're just like, wow, this bench, this is a Champions League quarter final. And I'm standing there thinking, what, he's got a choice between Skip and Sanchez. This is ridiculous. I just couldn't believe it. I thought, there's no way you're going to bring on Skip. And to his credit, he did the only thing I personally think he could have done. And I think it was a sensible substitution. I'm not saying the substitution worked. I mean, obviously, Llorente got the winning goal, but I also think that he's got deficiencies in his game that were exposed by City. City basically were quite happy for him because he's quite immobile. So they were quite happy to have someone like that who they could, because up until that point, they were finding it difficult to deal with Moura and Son. But yeah, I thought it was the only substitution he could make. I was, for a horrible moment, I thought, is he going to put on Skip? He's not going to put on Skip, is he? But he made the right choice. So, yeah, I mean, over the whole piece...
Has he gone up a notch in your estimations now because of that?
Has he gone up in my estimation? I think that he did. I think he did incredibly well over the two legs. And, you know, as I said, the first leg, I thought he managed it really well. Tactically, he got it right. They didn't go, you know, before the game, he talked about how they were going to, you know, be aggressive and go at City. They didn't do anything of the sort. I mean, I didn't buy that when I heard him say it in the press conference beforehand, but I thought that he got it right. And, you know, in terms of the decision he made before the game, whether to play Son and Moura or to bring in Llorente, all of those decisions he got right. So, yeah, he did well. He did very well. But to be honest with you, you know, going back to, you know, sorry, to keep saying well said to Jack or whatever, but you know, that was, I really think that luck played a real big part in that second leg.
See, you can't even just give him that.
You just give him the praise.
And then you just can't.
I'm not saying it like that. I'm saying that everyone, any team who wins any trophy, you need a bit of luck, of course. You know, when you look at it, you know, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying when Chelsea won the Champions League...
Oh, there was a lot of luck.
How much luck did they have?
There was a lot of luck there.
How much luck did Man United have when they beat Bayern in 1999? Yeah. You know?
That was all skill.
you get incredible amount of luck. And I'm saying that there was a certain amount of luck that was, you know, that saw us through in the end. Because, you know, it's incredible how important Sissoko's become as a midfielder for us, because once he went off, I thought we were just clinging on in the second half. You know, we didn't have a midfield because you then were asking Ali to come back and play in a position that he wasn't comfortable in, and Eriksen, and essentially we were just getting overrun by City. So I felt as though, you know, from that moment on, we were clinging on, and there wasn't much management going on, Jordan. It was just whether we
just
could
dig
hang
in,
on.
Yeah.
Just dig in and hang on. There wasn't much management going on. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying, he did badly.
Considering the last month, I suppose, what are you one of the people that wanted Solskjaer to sign long-term? Be honest.
I didn't mind.
You didn't mind, okay. Yeah. Having seen what Poch has done and what Solskjaer is now doing, I know there are circumstances around United and there's a bigger picture there, I get that. If you could take Poch next season and give them Solskjaer, would you take that scenario?
Oh yeah, I've lost Poch.
Give
for a
us
long
Solskjaer.
Time.
Ranieri's going to be out of a job.
No, I've lost Poch for a long time. So that was the guy I wanted above everyone else. Even if he was our guy, we still got guys that we need to get rid of, guys that he doesn't deserve.
There's a bigger picture.
I don't think this guy's even Solskjaer deserves to be in the dressing room sitting there with this. We've got enough trash in there.
Fair enough.
You know, but yeah, I would love Poch. Poch is a wonderful manager, in my opinion.
And finally, Jack, do you with Pochettino, do you feel that generally his stock, it's kind of an obvious question, but has risen a little bit now because he's, you know, knocked out Manchester City, one of the favourites. He's overcome Pep, albeit with a little bit of luck along the way as well. And he's now got a nice draw. We'll get into the draw when we get into Dutch talk in a little bit. But how far do you feel his stock has now risen because of that? And should he be kind of having half an eye on we can win this? Or is there still a lot to be done before he can lift the big ears?
Yeah, there's still a lot to be done. You know, it's a knockout competition. Anything can happen, as we've seen. But yeah, I mean, I think his stock's been high for a long period of time, if I'm perfectly honest. I think before Christmas, I think that Poch was probably the most in-demand manager in the world. Mm-hmm. I think that, but the two clubs you thought might pick him up off Spurs, and I think the only two places he really would have gone would have been United and Madrid, who have both
appointed managers
now. So I don't see Poch going anywhere. I think his stock is reasonably high. I think he's in that top caliber of that bracket with the real elite managers, and I don't think that.
Can you be elite without winning?
I was going to
say. Yeah, I think you can. I do like this. You know, there's this kind of idea of trophies being the be-all and end-all, and I do get that it's a, you know, competitive game and you are supposed
that
to win things. Yeah, of course. Of course, but I think
especially
that you
for the big clubs.
Of course, but I think you can impose a philosophy and impose a style and win big games without necessarily winning trophies. And I think that, you know, we've seen enough from Pochettino with you know, a very limited transfer budget, let's be honest. You know, he's not had the resources that a lot of other managers, I know you know better than anyone, Ollie, but he's not had the resources that a lot of other managers in that bracket have had. And he's still done an excellent job there. You know, you look at what Spurs have spent as opposed to the rest of the big six, and for them to be consistently, you know, in that top three bracket and really fighting out, you know, until, you know, January, we were saying maybe this is a three-way title race, you know, and yes, it fell off a little bit. But on the whole, I think he's doing an excellent job. I really do. And I think that his stock is as high as it ever was. I think he's very much in that bracket now.
Happy days. Just before we move on now to talk Dutch football, I appreciate most people listening to this beyond when we're recording this. It's currently 2-2 Chelsea Burnley, just so that the United and
Tottenham. Is it still first off?
It's still first, 24 minutes, it's now 2-2.
Wow. So, yeah. Sorry.
Are they like recreating last week?
They're trying to, yeah.
Like, lads, people like goals now, we should crack on, see what happens.
No one actually wants to finish in the top 4.
No one top 4, do they? Nobody wants it.
It's because everybody realises that the Europa League is an elite competition, and you look at it and you're like, yeah.
I'm enjoying it.
I love the Europa League. Honestly,
I'm enjoying
it. It's my favourite competition. It's the most exciting competition in Europe.
It's so random. Let's hope that Chelsea can follow in United and Arsenal's footsteps over the weekend of embarrassing themselves by handing over
Chris
that.
Wood. That so just shouting out Chris.
I think he scored the first. Oh, Barnes got the second.
Legend.
What a strike force. What a strike force they are.
They're not bad.
Have they been swapping goals? It wasn't 2-0 to Burnley.
I think it was 2. I saw 2-1 Chelsea.
It was 2-1 Chelsea.
And Burnley have just equalised. Okay, but this is all be dead news. By the time people listen to this podcast, Chelsea would hopefully have lost 5-2. Let's have a chat now, guys, about Dutch football, because I mentioned the top there. It seems that Dutch football is having a little bit of a return to mainstream football. And to do so, I want to bring in Michael Stratham from Dutch football website, Football Orange. Michael, how you doing, mate?
Hi, how you doing?
Very, very well. Cheers for coming on, man. So, Michael, let me start off with asking you, that there's been a long history in the era of Premier League of Dutch players, mainly attackers, coming to the Premier League. And I kind of get why, with the money and the language, it's appealing for them to come here. But why? Just tell us why you think Dutch players are so appealing to the clubs here, in terms of the football that's played in this country is very specific and very different to the kind of footballing culture and grooming that you have over there. What is it, do you think, that makes Dutch players appealing to so many Premier League clubs, and has done over the years?
I think first of all, it's very appealing for English clubs when they look at the low prices of Dutch players, or at least most of the time. Premier League clubs can easily pick up these players for good amounts of money. I mean, for example, Hakim Ziyech this summer. He's 26. He's been exceptional for Ajax for a number of years. He's been brilliant in the Champions League, and yet he could probably go for 25, 30 million. And to most Premier League clubs today, that's nothing. I mean, most Premier League clubs could afford that. I don't think Ziyech could probably want a mid-table Premier League move, but it's just an example to show that a lot of these players are quite cheap and very achievable for a lot of English clubs. I think the second thing as well is, as you say, you know, for players personally, it's quite appealing. So it's easy to pick when they've got a choice of Italian, often quite often it's Italian clubs from Syria, German clubs or English clubs. They probably will pick England. They know it's a really competitive league. They know that players have been there in the past and made history at loads of big clubs. But also you can look at players like Gigi Wijnaldum, the fact that he's gone to Newcastle after playing for a number of years with PSV in the Netherlands. He's forced a great career in the Eredivisie. On the European stage, he was pretty good at PSV. And then he gets to move to Newcastle, and, you know, and that's quite a middling club. But then after that, it didn't take long for him to get into Liverpool. And now look at him. I think he's just massively important. And he's an example that a lot of other Dutch players want to follow, I think.
Something else, we'll get to the return of Dutch football to the top table in just a minute, but it's just something I've always wondered. Why is it that so many Dutch players over the years are so injury prone? Or so I'm thinking of like your Van Persies and your Robins and Van Nistelrooy, you know, just before he joined United, had that was a bad fall, granted. I think Van der Vaart or Schneider, one of them two, was always injured. Is there something in the coaching and the training that happens in Holland that makes them more susceptible to picking up injuries?
It's an interesting point, that. And I think I'd point out the fact that the English training style is a lot more intense than the Dutch football style. You hear a lot of players that come to England and say, well, that was more difficult than it was where I used to play. And another example would be Daniel Schwab, who's the PSV centre-back. He's German, he's played in the Bundesliga for a number of years. And he moved to PSV recently, and he's doing well at PSV. You know, he made a good impression in the Champions League. But he said, wow, the training sessions in the Netherlands are so much easier. They're a lot more laid back. I wonder whether the different intense style of English football is maybe that is what causes injuries. Or it's just a big coincidence and I'm saying that rubbish.
Strootman, I just thought Strootman's always injured as well, if I remember.
Yeah.
Guys, if you have any questions, please just jump in. Michael, no Euros or World Cup that saw Holland in the last two major tournaments. How embarrassing was that for Holland? And was there a total reform in Holland like we saw in Germany in 2001?
As you say, it was an embarrassment. I think things are changing now, but there was a point where a lot of people were talking and writing about lots of different issues in Dutch football at club level, but also international level. There's so much negativity just a couple of years ago. It's just a culmination of factors that led to its decline. I think, first of all, the league, with bigger leagues getting bigger and leaving the Netherlands behind, that was probably the start of things. And then it didn't help Dutch international players as a consequence. You had loads of players as teenagers leaving the Eredivisie thinking, wow, I've had a good season or a good few matches for a Dutch club, and now this big club wants me, I'm going to go and sign for them. And then they can't fulfill their potential because they end up going to warm benches in bigger leagues, when actually by staying in the Netherlands and playing a lot of games, they can develop a lot better. And then that leads to a lot better Dutch national team players. But I think just there's so many factors I could talk about. But one of the biggest ones as well was a few years ago, Danny Blind was the Netherlands manager. He had a bad crop of players for a start, but also I would say he's pretty tactically inept. He wasn't very good at all.
Oh dear.
He couldn't adapt any of the playing style, and as a consequence, they failed to qualify for tournaments, and it all just went awry, really. A lot of things went wrong. But they weren't helped by a poor generation coming through either, I would say.
Jack, do you have a question?
I was going to say, how much has the kind of... Is there a kind of back-to-basics approach in a lot of it that has allowed, you know, a new generation to kind of unearth and develop? Or is that just a coincidence in what we're seeing at Ajax, I suppose?
I think it always comes down to a lot of factors, but what I will say is with the Dutch national team is it did take Ronald Koeman to take the crop of players he had. He was helped by some fantastic players coming through. I can come back to that a little bit later and how they were coached. But just with Koeman, the way that he took the squad of players he had and changed the formation, it seemed like it's just a simple thing. But the Dutch national team, for so long, had always played a 4-3-3. And Koeman said, no, we don't have a player for this. What's the point? So he plays five at the back, two wing-backs, a style we probably saw quite a lot when Chelsea won the league. But, you know, Koeman took that and it worked really well. The best players for the Dutch national team at that particular time, about a year ago, were centre-backs. Van Dijk, De Ligt, you have Ake, De Vrij. But also the wing-backs are pretty good too. And now it's come back to a 4-3-3 because Koeman's got these players through where he can play a 4-3-3 and go on the attack because he's got the confidence back. The players are coming through. And that's just how the Dutch national team have come back, I guess. But I guess if you want to know at club level, plenty of things have changed there too. I think players are staying longer in the Eredivisie and it's helping the bigger clubs get better. And therefore, on a European stage, they can compete. Saw that in 2017, Europa League final, but also now with Ajax in the semi-final, the Champions League.
Michael, this is a question to Michael in the studio here, so don't get too confused. I always feel, Mike, that when nations generally do well, it's because there'll be a crop of managers from that nation at club level doing well. So the Italians, the Germans, Spanish less so. But is there a coincidence that as we saw a generation of Dutch coaches kind of fade out, so I'm thinking your Van Gaals, your Hiddinks, the other guy that was, who's the other top manager that was, I think it was at Chelsea. Top manager, not Hiddink, Dutch, mine's gone blank. Anyway, it was the third one, it comes to me in a second. As they've kind of left the game, Holland almost brought through some younger coaches and managers. I know that you do a bit of coaching. Do you see a correlation in a phasing out of the last generation of Dutch managers and coaches with new ones coming through?
Yeah, that always helps because the newer coaches would have the newer ideas. That's the concept anyway. With the younger players coming through as well, you'll get them to work together and see what they can do as a unit. It's very good for Dutch football that they've got the next crop coming through. Because, you know, I think over here anyway, we still focus on the Van Gaals and so on and so forth. But, you know, we don't really see the young coaches coming through. We've always kept adding young players. And it takes a long time for us to realise who's coming through, who's doing this, who's doing that. Unless you're deep in the football world. I know some clubs over here knew about maybe De Ligt and those guys from the past. So, yeah, it does correlate. I mean, you spoke about Italy. 2006 when they won the World Cup, if I'm right. Yeah, 2006. Around that time, we had some great Italian coaches. Around that time, I saw he had like a team like AC Milan doing well in Europe as well. Mm-hmm. And then you have Spain winning, I think, back-to-back Euros and a World Cup. And with that, Barcelona and that... No,
it wasn't just those two. You know, Madrid were coming through then.
Yeah.
I think Valencia had a couple of decent runs in Europe,
exactly.
As well.
Sevilla then rising to start doing Europa League dominance as well. So it all correlates bit by bit and it all comes together. So it's great for Dutch football that started to happen. And shout out to Maika van Imo. He said, he's been here before. He said that at the beginning of the season that PSV and Ajax will cause a lot of trouble.
He did.
And they have big time. They have really caused these problems. So
he did. Yeah. Ollie, I'll ask Michael this question in a second, but I'll ask you first. What would you... Is it a case of when you bring through new coaches, you get new ideas, as Mike said, and then you get through new players, and that's when a generation for a nation really comes to the fore? Or is it maybe just a bit of a coincidence and it just happens to be Holland's time again?
Well, I don't... It's all about players in the end, really, isn't it? It's not really... The managers are important, but you've got to have the players to put everything into place. But I actually wonder with Dutch football, and maybe Michael can explain this to us a bit. When you think about Dutch football and think about the fact that, you know, this is seen, or rightly seen, as the place where pressing football was invented, why it kind of disappears for a time, and it's almost like the Dutch kind of forget how to do it, and then suddenly you get Ajax come back, and Ajax are playing, you know, the way they played against Juve. I mean, that was like watching the Dutch, you know, from years gone by. Mm. You know, so it was incredible. Like, Juve didn't have time to breathe. Mm. They were just, every time a Juventus player got on the ball, he just had three players just, you know, just basically robbing of the ball and taking it away. They were so aggressive and so fast, and everyone knew their role. And you just think, well, how does that disappear over time? Do you know what I mean? I don't know whether that's manager thing, or is that if that's a player thing, whether they're not producing the players who can play that, you know, that sort of football, or whether it's, you know, as you were saying, that the managers aren't really there anymore to actually push it on. You know, that's a really interesting point that I find.
Just to add on to that point, Michael, is it a case of that pressing football the Dutch were known for? Did they stop doing it, or did other nations just become better at it?
I think total football was kind of poked at with a stick when Netherlands were declining and the league was declining, and a lot of people said, oh, it's outdated, it needs to change. In the league, you're seeing teams every now and again coming up with different formations, playing a 4-4-2, 4-4-2 diamond, or five at the back. Utrecht are a good example of that in the Eredivisie. And the coach of that team that actually did that little bit of a shake-up was Erik ten Hag, who's now at Ajax. Funny enough, playing the 4-3-3 that Ajax play really well with total football. So these coaches do come along every now and again. But what's also really special about ten Hag and his predecessor, Peter Bosz, who was at Dortmund not very long ago, is that these guys weren't brilliant footballers. And it's great to see that these younger managers and coaches are getting chances, despite not having the name, to get a chance in the Eredivisie and then go on to achieve brilliant things. Robert Maaskamp, who's a manager from the Eredivisie from a few years ago, he managed Napoli and all that sort of stuff, he said that the old best players will get the best jobs first. And then we saw Mark Van Bommel, his first managerial role, despite working with Australia and the youth teams and what have you, his first actual managerial job was PSV. He walked straight into it. And whilst he's done a good job at PSV, I don't think you can say he's been exceptional. Whereas Erik ten Hag, who's had to work his way up from Bayern Munich reserve team, Utrecht in the Eredivisie, and now at Ajax, he's gone to achieve something very special. But also by playing something a little bit different. He did do some different tactical systems, and now that he has the players to work with, he can play with total football 4-3-3 that we're seeing with Ajax. You've got to have the right manager to do it, but yeah, you do need the players for it, I would say. And we are seeing some new coaches coming through. I think, just to add to the point I said about the Dutch national team with Koeman, he has been helped by Kees van Vondelen, who is a youth coach. He managed the under-17s Netherlands side that won the Euros only last year, and I interviewed him for Football World, Anya, and he just was really calm. He just had a great brain, and now he's been promoted after the Euros under-17s win to work with Ronald Koeman, and now we're seeing together they are working together to create this fantastic Netherlands national team side.
Just going back to my point on my brain fart earlier, I can't remember the guy I was thinking of, but just two others, Advocaat and Rijkaard, were definitely in that kind of pool of Dutch managers that have been phased out. Sorry, go on, Jack.
Michael, just a quick one. You know, obviously we've seen this Ajax side come through in almost two waves. The first wave that got to the Europa League final a couple of years back, and now obviously this kind of, you know, wonderful second wave fueled by that kind of youth element that they've got there. Is this, you know, the way that they play football and the way that they're so good on the ball, is this the natural conclusion of the Velvet Revolution?
Well, I think that the 2017 wave that we saw with the Europa League final, that was just the start of what we're seeing now.
Yeah, of course.
It's an absolute shame that they couldn't win that final, but Mourinho, he did use great tactics that day and he just nullified Ajax. I wonder whether if we play that final today, whether it would be the same result. Because so many of these players have developed. There are a lot of players from that squad that are there now, but they're a lot better. You know, Frank de Jong came on as a sub in that final. Now look at him. He's outstanding. What an outstanding footballer. And I couldn't recommend enough to those that haven't watched him play on a regular basis to go and watch him more, because he's just phenomenal. But just to add to that point about, it is a culmination. Yes, it is. And there's a lot of hard work that's gone into this. Overmars, who works above in the directors at Ajax, him and Edwin van der Sar have worked very hard. There has been some turmoil along the way with managers and what have you. Marcel Kaiser wasn't really the correct follow-up to Peter Bosch at Ajax after that Europa League final success. But yeah, no, now it's hard to come in. He's just revitalised the whole thing. And yet they have also drawn in some great experience. Both Daley Blintz, Dusan Tadic have really helped bring along these younger players.
Go on, Mike.
You mentioned Mourinho's United that they faced. Credit to them, because Mourinho, I think a couple of days ago, actually said that he went out there to fully nullify Ajax, which showed a bit of fear about how they play their football. He pretty much said, you know, we went there to stop them playing their football and then just make them uncomfortable to try and win the game. But my question was going to be, considering all the talent that's coming through now, who's the player or the players that they're looking to build around for the Dutch national team? Would it be like De Ligt? Would it be De Jong? Would it be the new rapper, Memphis Depay? Like, who would it be?
For the Dutch national team, yeah, those three names you mentioned are the people I would be really happy to build a team around. De Ligt in defence, him and Van Dijk, in my opinion, are going to become the best centre-back pairing we've seen in quite a while, the world. It's a big statement, but I think genuinely Van Dijk's been exceptional. If he keeps that form up for the next few years, Blitz is just going to develop more and more. Big transfer this summer.
Sorry, Michael, before you go into other players, I heard another podcast about 2 weeks ago, and there was a journalist talking about all these young players coming through. And he was making the point that everyone's talking about De Jong and everyone's excited about De Jong, and he's made his transfer to Barca and he's going to rip it up. But he was saying that in Holland, he thinks that De Ligt, just kind of what you was alluding to there, he thinks that De Ligt will have the bigger career. Would you, obviously different positions, but would you agree that of the two guys that are looking like they're going to be the next shining lights of Dutch football, De Ligt's ceiling is a lot higher than De Jong's?
I don't know. I think they both have a very high ceiling and probably about the same height. What is the difference, though, is that De Ligt is younger. He's only 19 at the minute. De Jong's 21. And also, what fits a highlight reel better? Skills, cool passes, dribbles, or big tackles and headers? I'm not sure what people would rather watch, but I know that on Twitter I see a lot more of De Jong's skills rather than De Ligt. But they're both equally excellent. And, yeah, I think De Ligt is... he could be better than De Jong, but I think both are going to have exceptional careers at the top of the club level and international level. But if to come back to how we're going to build the Netherlands team, I think, you're talking De Jong midfield, and Wijnaldum's doing a lot better in attacking midfield now. But Memphis Depay, brilliant in the attacking role. He's revitalised himself as a striker. Obviously been a winger for a long time. I know that he's getting more time in the Lyon team playing as a striker now as well. He's had a good knock-on effect for the Dutch national team. He's just so passionate to play for his country. And he links all the wingers and the attacking midfielders together, and it just makes the team so dangerous. I think it is also helped by the fact there isn't another decent option in the striker's role to replace Memphis. But equally, he's been a great player there nonetheless. And around that, you've got a lot of players who are sort of late 20s and filling gaps, really. You've got good goalkeepers, decent fullbacks. The players I mentioned are the ones that the team's going to be built around.
On that same show I was listening to, they were saying that the journalist was saying that he finds it surprising that it's Barcelona and I think Madrid that are heavily linked with De Ligt. But he was saying he was surprised because he felt that De Ligt's skill set was more suited to the Premier League. Just briefly, do you feel that he is more a Premier League, an English football-esque centre-back, or do you think that he's more of a player and he's more suited to La Liga?
He is a bit of a player. A lot of Dutch centre-backs are equipped with the great passing skills. He could play anywhere. I think you are right. He has got a bit of a physical edge about him that could make him suitable for English football. I just wonder whether he'd excel at for example, a Man City in straight away next season, whether he'd play every single match. I think he would be a lot more guaranteed to get a first team place at a top European club at either Barcelona, perhaps a Juventus, or even better than most clubs we mentioned, Bayern Munich. I think he probably fits in very well there.
I'll go right for just a couple more points. If Holland put out their best 11 and England put out their best 11, who are the favourites? Semi-final. You think Holland have got a better 11 than England?
Yeah,
Jack's giving me the look like, of course they do. they go into that semi-final as favourites for you?
60-40, yeah. Because England have got threats and very good players.
I mean, the caveat is that Harry Kane probably won't be in that game. So I suppose, yeah, the question
what
is...
What are you basing it on?
Yeah.
Harry Kane?
Yeah. Doesn't matter. De Ligt's going to pocket him.
I was understanding that he's out for a couple of months. That was my understanding. Do you know
never
more?
Never say never with
no?
Harry.
Okay.
Never say never.
Well, even
with
if
Harry.
He plays in that game, he's not going to go into that game 100% fit, is he?
No. He won't go into that game.
I'd imagine not.
He's getting ready for the Champions League, isn't he? He's getting ready for
the final.
Yeah, of course.
You wish.
Of course.
You wish.
Can I just ask, why is no one talking about Van der Beek as well? I think he's fantastic.
He's phenomenal.
Then no one's talking about everyone's wetting their pants about De Jong, but this Van der Beek, I watched him against Juventus. I thought he was absolutely fantastic. Why is no one talking about him?
Well, after the match against Juventus, I was out on Twitter saying he was man of the match. He was brilliant. Yeah,
he was man of the match by a country mile, but they just kept, and the commentary, they kept going on about De Jong, and De Jong was great, don't get me wrong. Listen, they were all fantastic. You know, the thing was, they were so good, Ajax, right? I watched both legs of that. You know, it's incredible. In this country, right, we should do everyone a favour, yeah, and say, you know what, you don't need to watch Man United Barcelona because Man United are just wasting everyone's time. Everyone should have taken an education, got an education for themselves, and sat down and watched Ajax both home and away. They were fantastic at home, and then away, it was just seriously. That is what you want football to be. That is what European football should be all about. They were brilliant, and you know. I pity anyone who wasted their time watching that second leg in the Nou Camp. Seriously, I'm not getting at you. You were already out.
No,
you know what I mean?
You're right.
I don't know why anyone would have sat down and thought, you know what, I got a choice.
They might do this.
I might watch that. I can't believe that anyone watched that game, but I'm sure many people did, but they missed out because Ajax, they missed out on a lesson in football. They were brilliant, but I thought Van der Beek was unbelievable, and yet no one talks about him.
Just tell us a little bit about him briefly, please, Michael.
Van der Beek is a great midfielder. He's all action. He's getting a lot better as a number 10 now, attacking midfielder. Before, he's a bit more defensive. That was probably his best match for Ajax at the same time. Like, he was great, but that was almost like he's been building up to that moment. Before now, at the start of the season, for example, he wasn't in the team. He wasn't a first-choice Ajax midfielder. Lasse Schürrle, for example, was keeping him out. And Erik ten Hag, again, if I come back to him, he's just managed him perfectly because he said to him that I don't think he's ready for the first team. And before the season started, Van der Beek thought, oh, well, now it's my time. Now it's my time to come into the team because players have left. So I'm naturally the next player to play in that midfield. And a lot of time that does happen in Dutch football where young players naturally just go into the first team. And Ten Hag said, no, I'm going to keep you out of the team. He, for a few games, Van der Beek looked like he was just working too hard. He was trying too hard to get back into the team when he came on as a substitute. But eventually, he got his chance because of an injury. He stayed in the first team ever since then. And Ten Hag has managed that perfectly by also tweaking the way he plays, by playing more attacking now, being more of a threat in the box. You saw that against Juventus. When he scored that goal, right positioning. Yeah, I just think that he's a great all-action midfielder who could do with another year at Ajax, first-team football, but he's coming into his own now. I just hope that he doesn't fall into the same kind of trap as Davy Klaassen because he was a good player with Ajax but then didn't go on to fulfil that because of, couldn't make that step up. I think Van der Beek's got more quality, but... Yeah, I don't know. That game against Juventus showed that he could make it. He could well make it a top European club. But let's see.
Michael, we'll finish on Ajax in the Champions League just one second. But just before we finish on that, I was wondering, a lot of people are talking about it's a shame this Ajax team's going to get broken up and we're just seeing it, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, of course, we want to see that team stay together as long as possible and try and do whatever. But I'm just wondering, are Ajax in that kind of group of European teams a little bit like Porto, a little bit like Roma, a little bit like, I don't know, West Ham, Southampton, that their success is developing players on the cheap in their academies and selling them on for big, big fees. They're never going to keep that crop. A little bit like Monaco as well.
Yeah. Can I just add, like, from that, you know, obviously there's been such a crop of this Ajax youth and there's so much talk about this setup, but we've already seen, you know, the likes of Ekelenkamp come in, you know, in those big games, and obviously another young player is, and some of the hallmarks of those vintage Ajax teams was having, when players moved on, they were able to just promote from within and have players not, you know, necessarily of equal quality. I don't think you're going to, you know, you only produce one Frankie de Jong every so often, or one Matthijs de Ligt so often, but of players that are able to step up and fill that breach and make sure that it actually kicks on from there.
Yeah, the key thing is that they get the chance in the first team. Ekelenkamp barely plays for Ajax, but then was just thrown on against Juventus and, you know, got that cheeky little yellow card against Ronaldo, which is great. But these players will always get those chances, and there's a lot of the players that you see in the Ajax team are there because they got that chance. The goalkeeper, Onana, he came in when he was a late teenager, and he took his chance, and ever since then he's been a first-team goalkeeper. I could go on. You've got like De Vit coming through at the moment. You're going to see Ryan Klavenberg coming through soon. He's only 16. These players get a chance. They're just thrown in.
And in terms of the structure at Ajax, is there an acceptance there? Are they comfortable with the fact that they know if we invest a couple of million in 20, you know, young prospects from the age of 13, 14, if one of that 20 or two of that 20 get to 17, 18, they can sell them for 80, 90 million. That, for them, they're comfortable with that? Or do they want to have a team full of young players that can do what the 95 team did all those years ago in the Champions League final? Is there an acceptance that success for them is selling on a De Jong? Develop him, move him on for 80 million. De Ligt, move him on for 120. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think a lot of Dutch clubs have accepted that. They're very realistic people, and they know where they are. They know where they sit. The same goes for teams lower down the league. They know that the bigger clubs are going to come for their best players, but they're also kind of happy that they've been able to send them on to the next stage of their careers because that's what they like to do. The same goes for Ajax. I'm sure they would love to lift the European trophy again, and it might happen this season. But that's what they want to do, and that's what they like doing. They pride themselves on their academy. And if that's to sell them on for big fees, then they continue in that vein. It's just the way that it's always been, and it will always be like that. Just a different level of success, I suppose. Hopefully now we're seeing a time where they can stay at the Dutch clubs for longer. But they know they're never going to stay there for their whole careers because they know they want to better themselves and try different adventures.
Ollie, Champions League semi-final, Tottenham versus Ajax. Who are the favourites?
Ajax.
No, Ajax are the favourites.
Yeah.
Go on, why?
Well
Kane's out for a start,
by dint of the fact that they've knocked out the holders and they've knocked out Juventus, you know, so, yeah, they've got to be favourites, haven't they? I think they've shown that they've, in the last couple of rounds, they've shown they've got no fear. They had Bayern in their group as well, and they did well against them, so I would say that they've got to be favourites. I mean, it's not much in it, but no. I think that they're definitely favourites, yeah.
Even though they're favourites, as you say, do you, as a Spurs fan, it's a little bit like England in the World Cup. If you were offered Ajax in a semi-final of a Champions League, you'd take that, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. If you'd have told me after the end of the group stage, we would get to the semi-final and we'd play in Ajax, I'd say, yeah.
Would you see it as an opportunity missed, as good as they are, if you weren't to get to the final?
Listen, if you're in any semi-final, if you don't get through, you're going to think it's an opportunity missed. We don't know, Jordan, because we don't know how the game's going to pan out. You know, who knows what's going to happen. You might go into the game and you might get smashed in one of the legs, and it's all over before you've even started. So it's hard to tell the story of the game before it actually happens. And you don't know who's going to be fit, and you know. It's important for us, for instance, to get someone like Sissoko fit. I can't believe I'm saying that now, but that's the truth of it. You know, without him, we don't have someone who can just move us up the pitch quickly and basically, you know, do that box-to-box role. And basically, you know, do all the donkey work so that Eriksen can do his stuff further up the pitch.
Otherwise, you're going to get passed to death.
Yeah, and, you know, that's the problem. We've got a problem if we don't have him in the midfield. I think that's a massive problem for us. So it's hard to say at this moment, Jordan, because I don't know who's going to be available. We've also got Son missing for the first leg, which is going to be a problem as well. But I still think, what I would say is that I think that if Spurs can come out unscathed from the first leg, I think they've got a chance. If they, because what we've seen is Ajax have no fear in going away from home. But when they play at home, they always concede. They always concede goals. So if we're in a tie going into the second leg, I think we will be able to score out there and we'd have a chance. But that's a big if. We've got to make sure that we don't go there like 2-1 down or something.
Yeah.
The bottom line is that when Ajax have won their last two rounds where they've had the home leg first at their place. And so, you know, this is the other way around this time. So it's important for Spurs to get
be in the tie.
And then I think, you know, both Juventus, Real Madrid beat Ajax in their own stadium. They were just too cocky come the second leg, weren't they? You know, and you had all this nonsense with Ramos giving himself a yellow card on purpose.
It backfired,
so,
didn't
you
it?
You know, it backfired. So I think that if they're in the tie, they've got a chance for the second leg.
Michael, Tottenham could start that tie with three former Ajax centre-backs. What's the vibe in Holland regarding that tie? Are they licking their lips? And secondly, where are they weak? Where can Tottenham really hurt this Ajax team?
Yeah, first of all, the feeling is they're not going to get carried away with it because, again, that realism, they know where they sit and they know that they've got a good chance still against Spurs because, yeah, no Kane, no Son, no Sissoko. Weaknesses? You've got to look at the players that might be out. There was a couple of injuries against Juventus, but then those that came in stood up to the challenge. Veltman at right-back and Sinclair at left-back. But then Tagliafico should be back and so should Mazraoui. So the full set of players should be available and should be fit. I think one of the things that is interesting is that I'm starting to see a few leggy players. Some of them are looking a bit tired and a bit dead out on their feet now for Ajax. They ground out a 1-0 win against Groningen in the Eredivisie. Tough place to go, Groningen, but equally, I did think that some of the key players were looking a bit tired. I think if Spurs can take it to, you know, along, if it goes to extra time, for example, I think you could see that that makes a difference to Spurs. And I think another key point as well, as you've already made, that Ajax play home second. I think that was also quite big as well, because that when they played away from home, Ajax had no fear at all and could go and get a result. As you say, Real Madrid got a result in Amsterdam and Ajax do concede. I think there's always that risk of them making a bad mistake. I don't just mean, you know, a mistake. I mean a proper dropping a clanger. I think Ajax have always got that within them. Spurs can make the most of something like that. I just wonder how Spurs are going to set up. I mean, I don't know what you guys think, but I was always quite interested if Spurs would change their tactics to counteract how Ajax were actually going to play, because there's always a no-fear sort of 4-3-3 gung-ho approach at home. And I just wondered if Spurs were going to try and defend that, they might stand a chance against Ajax. But I wondered if Pochettino was going to do that and tweak what he did.
We'll have a chat about that in just a minute, Michael. But cheers for coming on, man. It's Michael there from Football Orange. Cheers for your time, man.
Cheers.
Thanks, pal. So let's just wrap up with that question. How do we think, just briefly, guys, how do we think Tottenham will and should set up in that tie?
Three at the back. It has to be three at the back. That's very important. The only person I'm not sure about in that lineup is Trippier. I feel if Trippier gets destroyed, Ajax are going to target him over.
He's had a shocking season.
He is depressing to watch. He's almost as bad as Ashley Young. Almost.
Jesus, that's almost about the worst thing you could say to someone,
that's,
isn't it?
That's a question. That is. Well, at least Trippier is a right back.
Duh.
And Young's get out is that he's not actually a full back, to be
what,
fair
what
to
is
him.
He? But if they hold it well there, then I think they'll be okay. I think what Spurs can keep faith in is that Foyth has actually performed well recently, because he's settled and come to his own. So if Davinson Sanchez was missing, then I don't think they should worry too much about putting Foyth in as a replacement. I think they'll be okay there. And just try and hold it back, especially with Sissoko out, I think that's a big loss.
Jack?
I think what you were saying earlier about Sissoko's, you know, ability to break up play and kind of move Spurs forward up the pitch is so crucial. If they're missing Sissoko, I do worry for Spurs. I'm not sure that going five at the back is what I'd do, purely because Tadic loves the half space, and he loves, because, you know, playing in that kind of false role, he kind of steps off the centre-backs. And I think that having three centre-backs who are all a bit like, hang on, we've got no one to mark, might be a little bit, you know, risky. I think there's plenty to be said for trying to keep Ajax out. If Spurs keep Ajax out at home, they'll win the tie, full stop.
Ollie, briefly?
I think Spurs do exactly what they did against Manchester City and play the diamond in midfield, have the extra man, because you'll need it against their three who will be buzzing all over the place. But I think the extra man counted against City, and it could count against Ajax.
I won't ask Ollie, but in a word, who goes through?
Ajax.
Spurs.
Oh, I think Spurs as well, actually. I think Spurs do it.
I'm just a romantic at heart, mate. I'm looking for the Johan Cruyff final. I'm out here for it.
Listen, guys, you've come on the pod this week. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, also as well, across all the socials, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as well. Until next week, peace.